You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The development of the atomic bomb during World War II was a triumph of concealment and secrecy. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gary Wills argues that, as a result, the Manhattan Project and the birth of our nuclear arsenal forever changed the presidency and stretched executive powers far beyond what the Constitution's framers intended. His latest book, Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State, draws a direct line from the building of the bomb to the Cold War and to the current war on terror, all of which have added considerably to executive power. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Gary Wills back to our show.
Good to see you.
The Manhattan Project was kept a secret during World War II. Who in the government and military did know about it?
Very few people. Even the Vice President of the United States didn't know. Harry Truman, when he became Vice President, didn't know about the bomb.
He only knew about it when he became president.
They finally told him. No one in Congress knew. Remember, when he was a senator, Harry Truman was investigating expenditures of the war. And he didn't know. It was not through the military chain of command. It was not through congressional appropriation. The president set up a very small group, Conant and others, to direct it. And they kept it a secret from other parts of the military. Leslie Groves, who was put in charge, was given autocratic powers. He appointed his own successor in case he should die, outside of all procedures. He said, I've got the whole thing in my head, and nobody else would have that except the man I'm going to groom for it. He had his own little private air force. He had his own little assassination team. He had domestic and foreign surveillance. All of the things that the CIA would later be doing, he did during the war.
Did anyone question the constitutionality of this?
No. Well, in a war, very few people question the constitutionality of anything because, of course, it is an emergency, and emergency powers are always granted, whether suspension of habeas corpus in Lincoln's case or internment of Japanese Americans. All of those things occur during a war, but usually when the emergency ends, the emergency powers end. That was what was so different about World War II.
Well, I spoke to somebody else recently about the expansion of presidential powers, and his argument was that once a door has been opened, it's very difficult for the next president to say, I'm going to back out and close that door.
President Obama is proving that right now, isn't he? In the case of Truman, they impressed upon him that everything was an emergency now. The idea of a secret attack by someone getting the bomb was so scary that they persuaded Congress to say no one but the president can authorize the use of the bomb. With no congressional oversight or anything, they said, if there's an attack anticipated or occurring, there's no time to consult anybody. So one person has to make the decision to anticipate or retaliate. And once that power was given to him, others flowed. You have to protect the bomb by secrecy proceedings. You have to deploy the bomb by Strategic Air Command and bases around the world and that kind of thing.
And the president is the only one I've heard who knows the secret nuclear codes.
Well, there are other people who do, but that's also interesting. We have a constitutional succession of power if the president and the vice president are killed. But in the Reagan administration, they decided Speaker of the House and people like that who are supposed to be successors don't know how to launch all. They don't have all the technical equipment and the technical expertise. So they set apart a little group, Cheney and Rumsfeld of the presidential staff were among them. They were called in the middle of the night and said, go to an undisclosed location. That was the beginning of that term. And they conferred on what they would do if the president, if there was a decapitation, as they called it, if the government was, the head of the government was cut off. And they had the authority that nobody knew about and was not in the Constitution and not in the military chain of command to take over for the president.
This is a far cry from Harry Truman not knowing that there's even a Manhattan Project.
Yes, well, but nobody knew about this arrangement either for a long time. And now, you know what's happened? It worked. They did it. After the terrorist attack, Cheney was in the White House. Scooter Libby was standing at his elbow. They heard about that there were other planes up there. They thought it was pluroplanes. And Cheney's attitude was, there's no time to consult the president. It's going to hit any minute. And so he ordered the shooting down of the other planes. He did exactly what he would have done from the first undisclosed locations. So that kind of secret presidential power exists to this minute.
Although when Al Haig said that he was in charge at one point, he got an awful lot of flack for it. Dick Cheney, we've changed to the point where Dick Cheney could admit to it. In fact, you have a fascinating quote from him explaining all of these new powers. And there are many, you know, if you're a Democrat, you criticize him. If you're a Republican, you think that what he says is perfectly fine.
Haig made the mistake of openly saying that he was in charge. Cheney just did it.
Uh-huh.
He didn't publicize it.
Why? I understand why Leslie Groves felt that it was important to keep Congress completely in the dark about the Manhattan Project because it's almost guaranteed somebody would have leaked it. On the other hand, isn't Congress supposed to be an equal partner in that kind of decision-making?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's solely in charge of the spending of money, government money. And, of course, it had no way of knowing where the government money was coming from. And that it was all done through disguised conduits. The University of California at Berkeley paid a lot of the physicists. They were using government money, but it was laundered. And, of course, that's something that the CIA practices to this day, that kind of laundering of funds.
Well, Germany surrendered before the bomb was even tested, and there are many who believe now that the Japanese were on the verge of surrendering. The bomb wasn't really necessary to bring about the end of the war. What do you think would have happened if Congress had been brought into the decision-making process?
Well, whether the bomb was necessary or not, the Strategic Bombing Survey said not. Eisenhower said not. MacArthur said not. The economy was destroyed. The morale was destroyed among the Japanese. But Truman could not use the bomb. The attitude of Groves and others, including Oppenheimer said, you've got to use it because it won't be a deterrent in the future if we don't show that we will use it if we have to.
But couldn't we have dropped it on Mount Fuji or something like that and made the case?
Yes. Oppenheimer said the trouble with that is they were not sure the bomb was going to work for all kinds of reasons. If we said, we have this horrible thing and we'll just demonstrate it and it didn't work, that would be bad. If they warned them, get out of Hiroshima, that would be bad if it didn't work. And the whole point for Groves was that when it comes out, it's bound to come out, that I've commandeered all this talent, all this manpower, all these billions of dollars, all these 80 locations, and we had a weapon and we didn't use it. Every family of anybody who might have died in an invasion would be after me and would be after the president. And they seriously thought the president would be impeached and Groves would be court-martialed. So they felt they had to use once they had the weapon, the country would not put up with their not using it.
My guest is Gary Wills, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of many books, also professor of history emeritus at Northwestern University. His latest, Bomb Power, the Modern Presidency and the National Security State, which is published by Penguin. The Soviets tested their first atomic bomb in 1949. Did the United States know that they were working on developing nuclear weapons?
Yes, they knew they were working on it. They were surprised at how fast they got it. Groves had assured Truman that nobody else has the expertise, the knowledge, the discipline, the secrecy that we have had. So it'll take forever for anybody else to make the bomb. Most of the physicists knew that that was nonsense. They said, this is the kind of knowledge that can't be put back in the tube. So they were surprised by how fast, and then they felt that they had to develop the hydrogen bomb.
Well, didn't many of the scientists involved, including Robert Oppenheimer, oppose developing these more powerful weapons?
They were against the super, as they called it, the H-bomb, which Edward Teller had been promoting from the very beginning of the Manhattan Project. They said it was unusably destructive, that it's unthinkable that anybody would drop it because it would commit genocide. It would be indiscriminate destruction of everything around it.
And isn't that true?
Of course.
So who made the final decision to develop the H-bomb anyway? Was
Truman.
It Harry Truman?
Yep. And he said, as for the atom bomb and dropping the atom bomb, he said it never was occurred to him not to do it.
On the other hand, part of the problem here is that then people's loyalty was called into question. You may be making a scientific decision, but it was seen as a political decision.
That's right. The whole secrecy apparatus grew up around the bomb after the end of the war. And so the discrediting of Oppenheimer was part of that. The taking away of security clearances, the discrediting of anyone who doesn't have security clearance, the classification of everything even remotely considered connected with the bomb or eventually with national security, all of those things were thrown up as safeguards of the power the president had been given. And he was told over and over again that you must rule as an emergency president. Remember, Senator Vandenberg from Michigan said, if you're going to give aid to Greece, then you've got to scare the hell out of the country. And then everything was an emergency to Truman. Universal military training, we've got to have everybody in the army. The drafting of railroad workers, the seizure of steel mills, and the initiation of the Korean War. After all, the power that was given to the president was to respond to nuclear threat. Korea was not a nuclear threat, but Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, said to Truman, you must not ask for the permission from Congress to do this because it would cut down your instantaneous power to react to any attack.
Wasn't the election of Eisenhower an expression of the desire by the populace because he said he'd get us out of Korea? And then later his famous speech against the military-industrial complex, an attempt to retrench? Or was Eisenhower just part of the same thing because once the Cold War was in effect, there was no going back?
Well, there were two Eisenhowers. There was the Eisenhower who did sincerely want to have arms control, nuclear arms control, and was afraid of the nuclear weapon. On the other hand, there was the Eisenhower who used the instruments of the national security state, especially the CIA, to effect coup after coup after coup, you know, beginning with Iran. So he waged a kind of secret war with all of the national security state weapons that were given him. After all, he's the one who originally planned the Bay of Pigs invasion. He didn't get around to doing it, and we don't know exactly what he would have done. But Kennedy had inherited that and felt that he had to go ahead with it.
And then we had Johnson and Nixon during the Vietnam War, but they again had wars as reasons for keeping and expanding the presidential power.
And they used the secrecy. For instance, Lyndon Johnson said, if you knew what I know, you would realize that I'm acting prudently and justly in Vietnam. But you can't know because it's all classified. And the catch-22 in that is that when the Pentagon Papers were published, we found out that he really didn't know any great secrets. The use of secrecy is more to deceive the American people than the enemy. One of my favorite Gary Trudeau Doonesbury's, I have the original hanging on my wall. Someone goes into Cambodia and meets two Cambodians standing in front of their ruined house and said, this is an historic site. This is the site of the secret bombing of Cambodia. The Cambodian man says, oh, it was no secret. I said to Martha, see, there are the bombs dropping on us. It was secret because Nixon didn't want Congress to know. He wasn't keeping it from the Cambodians.
Gary Wills' latest book is called Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. It's published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Gary Wills, who's written a number of best-selling works, including Lincoln at Gettysburg, Cincinnatus, George Washington and the Enlightenment, What Jesus Meant, and Head and Heart. He has won a Pulitzer Prize. He is also a professor of history emeritus at Northwestern University, a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and other publications. And his latest book is called Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. It is published by Penguin Books. Wasn't there disagreement among the founding fathers as to which of the three branches would have the most power? is, I always thought that Congress was supposed to be kind of the dominant one.
Well, that's what Madison said. He said, in a republic, the legislative necessarily predominates. And after all, Congress has the last powers. It can impeach anybody in the executive branch. It can authorize war. It can, only it can spend government money. But all of those things were nibbled away at by the executive in various ways over the years, but especially during wars. But as I say, other wars, when the emergency ended, the emergency powers were cut back severely and sometimes almost entirely. But that didn't happen after World War II.
But it was the fact that the president was commander-in-chief that allowed all of those powers to be nibbled away. John Yoo claims that the employment of this kind of presidential power goes all the way back to George Washington in his military campaigns against the Indians. And we had plenty of campaigns against the Indians into the 20th century.
Well, campaigns against the Indian, or Jefferson's campaigns against pirates, are different from declarations of war against nations. Against the Indians, it was always difficult to know which tribes were involved and to sort that out, and it was more a question of territorial claims than of declaring a war on a nation. John Yoo's attitude toward the president's power over war is quite extraordinary.
Were you amused that his book was paired with yours for a review in the New York Times Book Review?
Yes. Various people on blogs have said Walter Isaacson, who reviewed it, is afraid of the T word, torture. You would never know from that review that you was the father of all those torture memos. So, you know, what you says about the war power, the Constitution says Congress shall declare war, shall have the power to declare war. He said, well, that doesn't mean anything because declare means simply publicize, not authorize. And his proof of that is one citation from an 18th century dictionary, Samuel Johnson's of all people, and he totally neglects legal documents and volumes. So he thinks that only the president can declare war, and Congress can simply publicize it and say, this is going on, as if a minister...
Well, we give it a little stamp of approval after the fact.
Well, not even of approval, just recognizing it's happening. It's like saying a minister who says, I now declare you man and wife, is just saying, you've been living together for a long time, and I'm just recognizing it.
Well, you describe what happened after 1947 as the development of the national security state. And that's been in effect ever since the end of World War II?
Sure.
Because of the Cold War?
Because of the Cold War and the War on Terror and...
Well, after the Cold War ended,
yes.
Before the War on Terror, there was still this period where things were supposed to relax, but did they relax?
They never did. No, Daniel Patrick Moynihan said at the end of the Cold War should have caused a lack of further classification. He said it was accelerated. It was speeded up. And the same thing has been going on ever since. Secrecy is something that feeds on itself. It protects the government from recognizing its blunders and errors and crimes. It gives a certain cachet to anybody who's involved. Moynihan had another good story. He said, the premise that Kennedy was working on in the Bay of Pigs is that a small group of Cubans invading at this Bay of Pigs would provoke a rebellion against Fidel Castro. He said, every academic expert and all of the journalists on the scene and all the people who had taken polls down there knew that Fidel Castro at that point was extremely popular after his revolution, that there was not going to be any uprising. He said, why did Kennedy think there was? Because the CIA and the military said, we have access to the secrets. We have clearance. These other people don't. They can't read the secrets.
But experts also warned President Bush or people in the government that Iraqis would not strew rose petals before the invading American army, even though Saddam Hussein wasn't popular.
I know. Because, of course, when you have three different tribal factions in a country, who's popular with one party is unpopular with the others. No, the whole idea that, well, first of all, that he was behind the attack on 9/11, that was baseless. The idea that he had weapons of mass destruction was baseless. So the fact that he was a cruel dictator, which can't be denied, was not the original justification for the war. Now they've fallen back on that because there's nothing left.
Before World War II, we had somebody in the State Department who said that gentlemen don't read each other's mail. The OSS was developed during World War II because it was obvious we did need some kind of spy apparatus.
Yeah.
And then the CIA after World War II. And all of this happens during the CIA's term. So
and the NSC and the NSA. There are many. And
why have so many different ones been created?
Because there's a great secret empire to be governed. We have 800 or so military bases around the world. And that started right away. The Strategic Air Command was created to deliver the bomb right after the war. And it had to be refueled. It had to land. It had to have launching sites. Then the submarines, nuclear submarines, had to have their apparatus. Then the intercontinental ballistic missiles had to have their apparatus. We had to have launching sites in Turkey. So you have this vast secret empire. And not only are there military and hardware considerations, but when we invaded Iran or Cuba or other places, we used cat's paws. We used soldiers of fortune. We used all these things. And that has grown and grown. There are now more contractors in Afghanistan and Iraq than military people. And these are people who are very hard to control. If you go against them, they can start blabbing the secrets of what they've been up to. When President Obama came in, why did he suddenly change his tune on military tribunals or renditions or torture? The various people went to him and said, wait a minute, it took us a long time to build these assets up. They're kind of unpredictable. You're probably going to need them somewhere down the road. Don't dismantle them. Don't be reckless about this. Well, that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on a president. And they say, you'll destroy our morale. You'll call into question our loyalty. And so it's amazing how quickly he backed off those things. And who else had, in a way, a better chance to wipe the record clean? But that's what happens with all of these. You know, when the Pentagon Papers came up, some people said to Nixon, let them be released. None of them apply to you. They were all during the Johnson administration. But he said, no, I don't want anybody questioning the president's power of the secrets. So once they have this domain, they don't want to give it up.
And President Bush's administration then extended the right of previous presidents, including a fair number of Democrats, to keep their papers secret.
That's right. He tried to weaken the Freedom of Information Act. He extended the time when the president's papers won't be released.
My guest is Gary Wills, whose latest book is called Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. It's published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, there were safeguards put into place to protect us against abuse of these powers. The FBI was supposed to take care of national domestic issues and the CIA international issues. And then Seymour Hersh, who was then with the New York Times, revealed that the CIA had been spying on its own citizens. He did that in 1975, making Richard Nixon furious.
Yes, and the NSA has been spying on citizens now under Bush. It's true, there were safeguards put in place, but they didn't work. Take, for instance, the Church Committee, which investigated CIA assassinations and other things. It put in safeguards, oversight, said that all of these things had to be reported to the Congress, to its intelligence agencies. And Casey of the CIA just flagrantly disobeyed them. Daniel Patrick Moynihan resigned in his position on the Intelligence Committee in protest at being lied to by the CIA. The War Powers Act was supposed to be a restriction. Even though Congress has the sole power to declare war, presidents had been declaring war so often that Congress said, well, wait a minute, let's at least get part of the action. So they said a president will have to notify us when he goes to war, and after a certain period spelled out by law, he'll have to come back and find out whether we want to continue support. No one has done it since.
Well, to some degree, isn't that what happened after the invasion of Iraq? Congress then pretty much said, okay, we'll support it. And if you had voted against it, you were likely to lose your seat in Congress.
That's right. It's very hard for the Congress, once you get men in action, men and women in action now, to cut off funds. Say you can't leave our boys in the field and our girls in the field without support. So once a president gets something started, Congress becomes very supine in its reaction.
Now, you've written also about signing statements here. Why did they apply to this discussion?
Well, signing statements originally were something that a president did to congratulate the people who had passed the law, mainly to point out the advantages of the law and that kind of thing. That's what Congress, that's what the court had said they were for in the early days. But then a few cases, a president started saying, well, I don't like this part or I don't like that part, so I'm not going to enforce it. But then that took off under Reagan and others, especially under Reagan with Ed Meese's Justice Department. And now it has become a raging fashion. You know, Bush did signing statements for practically every law.
Well, the numbers that you give us, 34% Ronald Reagan objected to laws that he signed on constitutional grounds. Then the first President Bush did so 47%, so that was an increase. Bill Clinton cut back a bit. It was 18%. And George W. Bush, 78%.
Yes. And, you know, a signing statement is either a pocket veto or nullification or a line item veto. And the latter two have all been declared unconstitutional, and the first is a dubious one. And the president, again, President Obama started doing signing statements, and there was a protest. And then he said, well, I won't make a signing statement when the law passes, but if I have earlier declared that I think something's unconstitutional, even without doing the signing statement, I won't enforce it. That's even worse. It's a stealth signing statement. And by the way, why does he have the power to declare something unconstitutional? That belongs to the courts, not to the president.
Now, Republicans are often characterized as being for small government, but here they seem to be supportive of an expanded government power. Democrats, often called promoters of big government, are generally opposed to this kind of expansion of powers. But would a Democratic president take a conscious step back on this matter, considering that Democrats are also characterized as weak on defense?
That's right. It would, again, be very difficult for him to do that. And, you know, it's true that the Republicans are for small government and low taxes in everything but defense. You know, they don't like spending money on domestic affairs. They don't like the government meddling in my business, as they like to put it, and they don't like the government paying for welfare cheats. But for defense and war and belligerence and pugnacity, the more the better.
So we were talking earlier about John Yoo, who has written a book in defense of what he did while he was in the Bush White House. Has it changed the nature of the presidency forever? I mean, whether a president says, okay, you can waterboard or you can't waterboard, in the end, doesn't he have the power to make that decision now, whereas in the past he might not have been thought to have that power?
Well, some of the things that you wrote in his memos have been rescinded by Jack Goldsmith and others. The Justice Department has backed off, but it has said it will not prosecute him for breaking the law. It just said he made a bad recommendation. So there is some backing off. On the other hand, Obama has said we're not going to prosecute torturers. He said torture is against the law, but I'm not going to enforce the law. He said we can't look back. That's what all the presidents say, because that's how it accumulates. They say I'm not going to be retrospective. I'm not going to punish my predecessors, but we'll reform it. We won't do what they did. And then they go ahead and do what they did.
Well, one of the ways that government power is kept in check is that there are people within government who are horrified by some of the things that they see, and they leak the stories, and we've seen that again and again. How were the torture memos, which were written by John Yoo, and unwarranted wiretapping, extraordinary rendition procedures, kept secret for so long?
Well, the way they came out was, I don't know whether it was through whistleblowers or by court action, but whistleblowers have a very tough time of it. They are discredited, they're attacked, they're considered disloyalty, they're considered disloyal, they're considered unpatriotic. And so to become a whistleblower takes a lot of courage or a lot of stupidity, one of the two. So, yes, these secrets are kept for a long time. And especially because the aim of the secret is to protect government. And anybody who doesn't want to protect government is attacked. Let me give one good example of that. The case of Reynolds versus U.S. An Air Force plane went down, which had some electronic experimental equipment and some civilian experts on. Some died, some did not. Some perished and some survived. And the relatives of some of the civilians who perished heard from survivors that there had been some hanky-panky on the plane. It had a very bad record. The people were not told the procedures for bailing out if they got into trouble. Didn't even know where the exits were. So they sued. And the government, the Air Force, said, well, there were state secrets aboard, the electronic equipment. We can't release the investigative report that we did. In two courts, the judge said, all right, I'll honor that. Show me the investigative report in camera, and if there's something that has to be withheld, I'll withhold it. The relatives won in those courts. It went to the Supreme Court under Vinson during the Korean War, and he said, we are at war. We can't undermine the morale of our Air Force, and therefore I won't even look at the document in camera. Now, that has been used as a precedent in many cases since then, upholding the idea of state secret. But the investigation was declassified routinely later on, and to the surprise of the survivors, they found a way to get at it, and they found that there were no state secrets at all in the investigative report.
Just people protecting their own
butts. But there was proof of criminal negligence on many scores. So they tried to take it back into court, and now, under Rehnquist, he said, oh, no, we can't honor their ideas because Ted Olson had advised them that even if there weren't state secrets, there were things that could make them presume state secrets. That's called the mosaic theory. If you have one little pebble from a mosaic, you can reconstruct the whole mosaic. So anything that's remotely connected with the military is, by that token, a state secret. And that's really what the aim of state secrets. It's to protect the state. It's not to fool the enemy.
God bless America.
Yeah.
Gary Wills, his latest book, Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State, is published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Good seeing you again.